Hi, John, how are you?
Good afternoon. I call to order this 57th meeting of the Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingart. I live in Children's Service. I'm a captain.
Joe Cocker, Veritas Catcher.
Quentin Trano, Assistant Commissioner.
Eric Peterson, Clarion County Freeholder.
Debbie Pascarelli, Warren County.
Thank you. at the State Planning Commission on October 24th. And on their agenda for that day was the consideration of the MOU between the Office of Smart Growth, State Planning Commission, and the Highlands Council. The result of that meeting from the Planning Implementation Committee was that that MOU was sent to the FNC with no changes, and it was unanimous vote by the Planning Implementation Committee. You've all seen that MOU, and the public is on the website under the State Agency Coordination in October. There was one revision to that MOU, and that was because under the plan endorsement guidelines, there were some provisions which would affect the Highlands Council when we were considered for that endorsement. So we had to propose and make some application to waive the certain requirements for the Highlands Council and the Highlands Council. Those were
consider that as a full council, though you did have your interagency committee meeting under Jack Schwier as the chair. The three waivers, just to let you know what they are, the plan endorsement new guidelines request that there's a requirement to create a plan endorsement advisory committee. And we ask that that be waived because the Highlands Council serves that purpose. And the plan implementation agreed to that, committee agreed to that. Also, there was a requirement for a self-assessment, and again, we feel that the Highlands Council has met the needs for any self-assessment, with the exception of the requirement to perform an assessment of the consistency of the Regional Master Plan and implementation mechanisms with the goals, policies, and strategies of the State Development and Redevelopment Plan. So we would do that portion of the self-assessment. The rest of it really has been done in the type of analysis that has been undertaken by this council and the staff. And the third provision was that was a provision for a vision statement. And again, that work was done through the Highlands Task Force, the legislative hearings on the Act, and the ongoing work of this Highlands Council and the public participation at your meetings and in the public comment process. And again, Plan Implementation Committee agreed with that. So those three waivers are included in what was sent to the State Planning Commission and what will be considered by ourselves. I did want to introduce two new members of staff who have joined us. Laura Forrest is outside on... Oh, she's here. Sorry, Laura. She's here. We're delighted to have Laura join us as an administrative assistant. She's working with us part-time. She comes to the council with experience in administration and has environmental education certificates from Cook College in Rutgers. She shares our passion and our commitment, and we're delighted to have her on board. Welcome, Laura. And the other person I'd like to introduce to you, standing at the back, is Nancy Benecki. Nancy has started as our manager of communications. She would, as I'll be sending out an email to all the press so that they'll be able to contact us now through Nancy. And also she'll be dealing with a lot of our ongoing outreach and our education, all of those different communications. She was the public relations officer for the Netherlands Commission and has worked for several newspapers, so she comes with a great deal of experience. She has a degree in English literature with a minor in communications. We're delighted to have her on board. Welcome, Nancy. The other updates I just wanted to give you was just a little bit of outreach that's been ongoing. We met on October 22nd with Norris County MUA officials and the engineer to discuss water and waste expansion bill. That pretty much wraps up what we've been doing with the exception of everything that will be revealed to you in the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. me just say, I noticed a few people here who I don't think have been at previous meetings of the Highlands Council. Welcome. The material we'll be discussing today is on the tables at the back. Welcome to take that. Our schedule as council is, after this meeting, we're not scheduled to meet again until next Thursday. When we meet at 10 o'clock. And then we're starting our meeting schedule. After that is Monday, November 19th at 4 o'clock. The TDR committee met, we discussed this at the last meeting. I don't know, Scott, if you want to add anything at this point.
Well, let me apologize to the board. I really wanted to be here for that discussion. Unfortunately, I was down in Newark. My company was finishing up the Prudential Arena, so that was the 11th hour for us, and I just couldn't get away during the day. I know everyone discussed it, and like I said, I'm sorry that I wasn't here for it. So other than just affirming that we did indeed have that committee meeting, which the minutes are in the package, would be about it.
All right, we turn to discussion of regional master plan issues. And we welcome Kurt Olstead. Now I think we do have all council members here. Here or on.
See, those 4 o'clock meetings really help in a lot of ways.
4 o'clock.
Right. See what they feel like at 7 or 8 o'clock.
My seat won't go down, so I'm more elevated. Sorry, Jack, I would love to caught that. We do have a PowerPoint to guide the discussion, in particular to assist the public in following it, but you do have a packet wherein everything, all the information that is being spoken of is in your packets that was sent out to you. We'd like to start with the update on our land use analysis decision support system, otherwise known as LANDS. And in particular today, what we're going to focus on is the zone map output from the LANDS model. The LANDS model basically contains all our information of mapping. It's got an incredible depth of information and data that's available through this model. And the tool then, we've worked on this to come up with a new zone map, which we'll speak of today to you. I do want to acknowledge the work of the staff on this. We're very proud of what we're going to be showing you today. And we put together a team, our GIS unit led by Roger Caron, and then we put together what was known in-house as a LANDS team, which was the GIS unit and planning and science. All of the staff really have had a hand in it, but the hours that were put in by that LANDS team, and in particular the GIS unit, went beyond 5 o'clock in the evening, whatever it took to get it done and to get this to you today. So I'm very, really proud of them and proud to bring this to you today. The output, the zone map, is based on 21 indicators which characterize the Highlands region and assign the most appropriate overlay designations. This output is a direct result and response to comments received from the public, from state agencies, and from yourselves. So using that information, the team went back to look at the model and to refine it. The original model that was released, and the output of which was released November 2006, was made up of 51 indicators. We still have all of those indicators and will be using them through the conformance process and at site plan review. But what we've done now is simplify the model, and we're getting a very true result, and again responsive to the comments received and taking out any duplication. The indicators that went in, these 21 indicators, fall into three categories. Feature-based indicators, which are the location and extent of geographic features within the region. Intensity indicators, which are density mapping. They show the magnitude to which an area in question includes those particular features. And finally, integrity-based indicators, and that's the relative degree of quality of a particular feature. And an example of that would be riparian corridor. We have a high integrity based indicator. So it goes to the quality of those features. The result of that mapping is that we have three primary zones. Those zones are the protection zone, which consists of high resource value lands that are important to maintaining, rather more than important, are critical to maintaining water quality, quantity, and sensitive ecological resources. Land acquisition is a priority in the protection zone, and development activities there will be extremely limited. The conservation zone consists of acres with significant agricultural use lands interspersed with associated woodlands and environmental features that should be preserved when possible. Non-agricultural development activities would be limited in that area. The third zone is the existing community zone, and that corresponds mostly with what was previously known as the land. The existing community zone captures what was already on the land. It captures the degree of development that reaches a certain level of intensity, either because of the current cover, population, and the heat. And that's one of the existing zones. There are areas with reasonably significant concentrated development that are sitting on the land. The areas may have existing infrastructure that may support development and redevelopment, provided that they have the protection and capture of the island environment, and is also appropriate to the municipality's establishment. And I will remind you, as we always do, anything is a model. The lands model utilized the 75 acres minimum maximum threshold for delineation of the following zones. However, I will tell you that the level to which this map is revisited is to a 50 by 50 meter distance. We can use that level of data to work with the site planning subzones will speak to the public and our state agencies and to yourselves of the level of commitment and the response to comments received that is will be indicated in this next generation Highlands Regional Master Plan. We're still working on the shape files for the mapping, making sure that we do quality assurance on the mapping and get everything ready so that we can release the shape files. The process that we use can be replicated. It's not raster-based, as was the case on the former model that was released in 2006. So this, we can share all the data layers, and it can be replicated. But this, we wanted to show you now an example of what it looks like in reality. This example here shows you the green is protection zone. The brown and tan layers are the conservation zone, that's the lighter color there, and the subzone, which are the environmentally constrained areas, are in the darker color. This next slide shows you, again, the output of the lands model for the zones, and this shows you the existing community zone and the environmentally constrained subzone within that zone. So it speaks to the environmental features that are captured within the zone and need to be treated accordingly and planned for accordingly. This slide also shows you the lake community zones. Again, areas, lakes of greater than 10 acres. In this case, the one I'm showing you now, the circumference is fully the lake community zone, and that's because it intersects the subzone. It intersects the existing community zones with a certain level of development already in this particular lake. In this example here, you can see that not all of the areas intersect the existing community. This is the lake subzone. This area here would be captured in the lake mountain area, but not all of the subzone. And this last example really captures parts of all three.
That has now been amply clarified. I'm very pleased to see that, and I think that those municipalities that had that fear will also be pleased to see this distinction drawn, these distinctions. So,
why didn't we think of that name
the
last time?
As I recall, Janice suggested that here last time. Let's go, Debbie, what's your question? Comment. Debbie?
I'm sorry, I have the phone on mute. To Eileen's early comments about the number of criteria that have been reduced in the second model and the simplification, who determined that we needed simplification and what was the basis for it and why do we do that? When you do a mathematical model, the number of factors you use is significant because it's computerized in this day and age. So. And I haven't read anything that explains that or justifies that.
Debbie, this is Charlie Seaman.
Hi, Charlie.
When we reviewed the map and the criteria, the 51 indicators that have been used before, we suspected that the numbers of criteria in each category were resulting in a more gross characterization of the landscape and not the more detailed landscape indicators that we thought we needed. So staff did a sensitivity analysis of each of the indicators to find out what were the primary determinants of the resources and how they overlaid. And what we learned was that as we took out some criteria that overlapped, we were masking the differences that were very important. And they revealed the way the map originally worked, the methodology was that if it met the protection area zone criteria, it was protection zone, no matter what other characteristics might exist in that area that were overlooked by, in practical effect, by those categories. As we reduced them, we began to see things that weren't evident. And the most significant of those are in the conservation area and in the existing community area. The environmental resources in those areas came up and became suddenly visible to us. We knew they were there. We knew in the conservation area that there were substantial critical habitats there and substantial forested areas. And they were being masked by the methodology and the numbers. So actually, while we reduced the numbers, I believe very strongly that we got more accuracy and more reliability and more replicable ability to replicate it by having fewer, more discrete criteria instead of stacking them. So I think the map got much more discrete, and the three zones, really, the constrained zones, the land, lake management zones, the environmentally existing community environmentally constrained, and the conservation area environmentally constrained, I think represent a very important refinement of the land use capability map and going forward as a framework for administering the goals, policies, and objectives through the programs.
Thank you. And the word, it's true, it's truth, or something was used, what does that mean in describing the new map? Eileen used that word.
Well,
and the results of the map are true or truth?
Well, what I think, what I don't recall the specific phrase, but what we know is when we run the map now and compare it to what's on the ground, we get a very consistent outcome. We are not seeing areas that were previously, I know an area that is already developed, or I know an area that is doesn't make any sense to be in this category, or I know an area that should have been in the protection zone. Those, because of the raster map basis, we could not go back and identify why they were in one category or another. Today, when a question is asked, we can tell you precisely why that land is within a particular category. And if you want to know what were the conditions that caused it not to be in another one, and I think that's what we mean by it is an accurate or a true map of what's really out there.
Thank you. Could you clarify what Jack was trying to say? A little trouble hearing him, and also more in the context of the technical aspects of the map.
What Jack asked?
Or what Jack, you made some observation, if you could explain that better to me.
I'll just say Jack's comment was to express support for changing the name to existing community.
Okay.
So let's move on to the goal.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Yes.
You can understand what constraints are applied to the environmentally constrained subzone of the existing community and the conservation. We have a lot of standards that we've developed for these various zones. Do the standards apply to the existing community zone the same as the existing community zone environmentally constrained subzone? Are they the same standards, or do they change?
It's not a simple answer. There are a lot of different kinds of programs. Some of them have fairly definitive standards, specific standards, and some of those standards vary. In many cases, the environmental protection standards in the protection zone and in the environmentally constrained zones are the same. In other words, the same set of protective criteria are in place to protect the same resource, whether it's in the protection area, the environmentally constrained conservation zone, or in the environmentally constrained existing zone. Other subject matters it's less important in the existing. Some of the wildlife criteria, for example, don't apply in the environmentally constrained existing community area because it's in a different context. And so they've been calibrated at a very high degree of reaction to not only the character, but its context.
Well, for instance, take septic density. Would in the conservation zone, environmentally constrained subzone, does the conservation zone septic density apply?
The
protection zone.
The
septic density, we we haven't pinpointed where the actual development should occur. We've given the yield by zone by HUC 14. And that will be a matter for us to work with communities through conformance to see, and that's where there's some flexibility, to see where they wanted to utilize those opportunities. Certainly the information would be again used during conformance to show them where those environmental constraints are and to see what they actually are and if they are in truth existing in those lands. So for example, if it's critical habitat, to do an analysis. So it really calls out the need to do further planning in those areas and provide the information as to whether there are existing on the ground environmental constraints. But as to exactly where the septic density is by zone, by HUC 14, not by constrained subzone.
Okay, so the answer is the target, the nitrate target, for instance, for the existing community zone environmentally constrained subzone would be the same for less factor. For the existing community zone environmentally constrained subzone would be the same as for the conservation zone. It would be the same.
We didn't establish a target for the existing community because we're going with the 2%, because that would be, they're mainly served by wastewater systems, you know, by sewer. In the case of the conservation and the protection zones, the median is for the entire zone, which includes the environmentally constrained. That's what the analysis was done. It wasn't that we didn't do the analysis for them separately for the
to what the resource is, what its context is, what its vulnerability is, and in applying the performance standards.
Right, but it's context within the zone, not necessarily its
its unique geographic context, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's in Bedminster
or West Milford,
if it's an environmental area in the conservation. So we should be able to articulate what those, what that matrix looks like, right, prior to the end of the plan.
I hope so.
We also saw the opportunity to use this for as a preservation tool as well. So when you see these, as you spoke to, Tim, in the existing community zone, you've got those environmentally constrained areas, and in many cases they were woodlands, there's an opportunity there to look for preservation as well. So it's not just about...
control for it. Our experience is the regional or state plan does not provide an opportunity for merit-based discussion to reflect a better idea for you about it. But it's based on that within some context that there will be a tendency to become a sum. Close the door before you start the process by step.
Sorry, you're sorry, no. I thought you did a great job in presenting the concept of the way. My concern is that this is going to be a slippery slope to modifications of the plan. The idea behind a regional plan is to set a comprehensive integrated plan for the region. I did talk this through, and I think John Alley said, obviously, the
you are correct, we need to clarify that for the purpose of this. Very troubled by seeing this in here, and with all due respect to Charlie, I couldn't disagree more. I think having the type of policy in place is definitely contrary to the goals of the Act. You know, we've talked in the past, you know, this is a conversation that we're having under slightly different circumstances, but it is the Water Planning and Protection Act, and that's the ball that we're supposed to be keeping our eyes on, and that is a objectivized things through all the data and the analysis that we've conducted over the last 2.5 years. And when we do planning at the local or at the municipal or the county level, in some ways it's very subjective. And, you know, that's the best we can do in some circumstances. But I've said to many would-be rezoning request applicants to keep in mind that look at our master plan for my municipality and our zoning ordinances. These are not suggestions. These are the plan, and they were put in place after very careful thought and for good reasons. And we're not, while we certainly and are required under land use law to consider any deviations from that, it is not a compilation of suggestions. It's something meaningful to be implemented. And when I hear with this flexibility process, I think of the same thing. Whether we call it going to be petitions to seek amendments, it will be very subjective. I don't think it can be held to any kind of standards whatsoever once that door is open. And if we go down this path, I think we're going to end with the regional master plan being nothing more than a field that exercise. We'll get town conforming to something, but it isn't going to be a regional plan. So I strongly suggest that we remove this or find some other way to accommodate what the issue is in a way that's much more consistent with development of a regional plan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. just don't need flexibility in their decision making. However, I feel the judges look to inspection and they have this sort of criteria to dispose of cases in the life. And I think if we are actually going to continue to keep the policy, that it would be important for us to flesh out several criteria, because as you all see coming to the high-level meetings, there's always a majority and minority interest that go around. And I don't think that we would go anywhere more conformist if there's a situation in which there's no sort of criteria which we can somewhat judge the situation of the municipality or with regard to the county. And this has to be, in my opinion, something that needs to be having these criteria set forth. And I guess that's the only way in which I could actually agree to have this policy here. There has to be some kind of criteria set forth. Or we're just going to go around in circles and go around in circles. And ultimately, in my opinion, circumstance is the real goal of policy impact, and that is the board's protection.
For the criteria, I think the criteria are in the facts that the question is. We may or may not find it to be adequate this week, and we need to be able to use the criteria, especially with the size of the time. It sounds like a solid majority of council would keep us in and have that discussion this week.
Master plan and the zoning, but here municipalities are required by law to update their master plans every 6 years, and that then leads to the updating of their zoning ordinances, the changes that they make. And so, even that reflects the fact that there are changes that have to be taken into account in the community. And I think they do that.
I don't think that our ultimate goal and the idea of flexibility are mutually exclusive. I think that this can work, but I have also a goal to investigate specifically. I'd like to see
The next items before the council, the next few items are really updates of matters we've already discussed, and we want to update you and provide you with the mapping on these issues. The first, water supply and wastewater utility capacity. And first, we deal with the Highlands Public Community Water Supply Systems. We've identified facilities that serve any portion of the Highlands region, regardless of whether the water treatment facility itself is located within the region, and their water allocation permit limitations and bulk transfer contracts in millions of gallons per month. We determined the peak monthly demand for each facility for the years 2002 through 2004, compared the peak monthly demand to the monthly supply, and determined whether the system has remaining capacity or a deficit. Note that this value is for the entire system, including both Highlands region and other service areas. And finally, identifying the existing areas served, both within and outside of the Highlands region, to determine what portion of the service area is within the region. And we have now a map that's updated that shows this information graphically. Hard to read at this scale, but this shows you where what the water system availability is and capacity is. It's an update and an update of the mapping. So it's really just an update. There's no consideration except that we promise to update the information unless we have it. All of these maps are part of the lands to flood projects. The next update is water supply, again, and wastewater utility capacity, but in this case it's to do with the Highlands domestic sewerage facilities. Again, going through the same process, identifying the facilities that serve any portion of the Highlands region, regardless of whether the treatment facility itself is located within or outside of the region, and their permit or wastewater management plan limitations for flow. The facilities are limited to those serving more than a single property, eliminating non-community, commercial and industrial systems. Identify the existing area served, again both within and outside of the Highlands region, to determine what portion of the service area is within the region. Determining the maximum 3-month discharges for each facility for the years 2002 through 2004, and prorate that amount to the Highlands region depending on step 2, the one above. The process of prorating discharges is necessary in the absence of facility-specific information on wastewater flows from each portion of their surface area. More detailed information could modify these results. We then compared the Highlands portion of the discharge flow against the Highlands portion of the permitted capacity and determined whether the facility is in deficit or has remaining capacity. Again, this is an update. We did receive in comments on the 2006 draft more information pertaining to existing areas served. And again, this is the resultant map of that, of those updates. Is calculating the septic system density and yield. And in this case, there was considerable conversation and discussion and debate on this issue at the last meeting. We've brought you an update of that report, and now it is in full and complete. And we've done the analysis to determine what the yield would be, and we've done it in two manners, which we did outline to you at the last meeting. Just to calculate the septic density and yield. Within the preservation area, the Highlands rules will apply. For the planning area, the septic yield calculations are not included for the existing community zone, and that gets back really to Tim's question on existing area served, and primarily existing community zone is served by sewer. So that's why we didn't do a septic density calculation for that particular zone. It would be anticipated that that would be on the additional development would be on the, in those sewered areas. So this septic system density and yield is for the planning area, conservation zone, and protection zones.
I have one watershed where I'm from.
You have
are the planning area, conservation zones, and protection zones. The computed median nitrate concentrations for the protection and conservation zones have been slightly modified from what we gave you at the last meeting, because they're modified to be consistent with the output of the zone that we just showed you from the land model. And those zones for the planning area, for the protection zone, it's 0.72 milligrams per liter, and for the conservation zone, it's 1.87 milligrams per liter, respectively. For groundwater recharge, the annual drought recharge was estimated for each 114 sub-watershed by using GSR 32. In the first table that we've given you, we excluded the preserved lands. This was part of the conversation at the last meeting, whether or not to include the preserved lands. The first table, excluding the preserved lands, the total septic system yield, conservation protection zone for the planning area, is 6,928. The second table includes the preserved lands, and in that case, for the planning area, conservation protection zone, the total septic system yield is 8,160 units. And staff then wants to come up with a recommendation for the council for consideration as to whether or not
Thank you.
That's why we added that stipulation in, that it has to be consistent. So if there are rules that go the other way, then we have that stipulation in. But given at the moment the guidance they're given is that they will allow the calculation to be done either way. The map to show that system density yield. But you have to remember when you look at the map that it doesn't include the preservation area, neither does it include existing community zones. So that's it's really just these areas where we've calculated the yield, and you have the yield in the numbers of septic. This is the default mapping. This is not the additional septic that would be gained through including in the calculation the preserved lands. The key then to the septic yield in the conservation zone are these numbers, and the ground tones, and in the protection zone is being listed. Yes, Mr. Schreier.
Oh. Every month.
Dad, I think Roger might want to dispute that. Yes. Okay. Oh, sorry.
General question about the methodology. And so in allocating the septic inputs across the box, will that meet the target, the actual target, to both up basis and on individual lines? Do you have to
surface water quality restoration is requiring municipality-wide fertilizer ordinances to deal with that issue. But it also, if it's a relatively small increase, it could be something where it's more localized in scale. It really is going to be depending on how much you're trying to mitigate. It's a lot easier to mitigate, you know, two or three additional septic systems than it is to mitigate 200 or 300 additional septic systems. Not that there's any subwatershed where that would happen, but just to
But we wouldn't restrict it. Any way they could, the municipality could manage it, it would be okay.
I think the focus needs to be on the subwatershed. That's the key, is to achieve the mitigation in the neighboring subwatershed doesn't do anything to reduce the impact of that additional okay. yield in the first subwatershed.
Okay.
The next update is in the calculation of net water availability. There's a document dated October 31st, has a narrative and then a table that chronicles the calculation of net water availability. The net water availability is done on a HUC 14 subwatershed basis. There are three components. The first is the sustainability of water resources. That's the groundwater capacity. The water that is available for human use, groundwater availability, and then the remaining water after existing consumptive and depleted uses are deducted. That is the net water availability, and that is the principal criterion that will be the performance standard for future development in the Highlands. There are thresholds for potable water use. They vary. And in the protection and conservation zones, the threshold for potable and non-agricultural uses is 5%. That represents a modification from the November 2006 plan, which had 10% for all uses in the conservation. The non-agriculture has been reduced. And the agricultural uses within the conservation zone are 10%, and in the existing community zone is 20%. The consumptive and depleted uses are those uses that are not returned to the subwatershed by discharge back into the ground or stream. So if the water is being used and returned to the source in that subwatershed, then that is not a consumptive or depleted use. The analysis compared the consumptive and depleted uses against groundwater availability, and this is called net water availability. And we have discussed before that the RMP includes a conditional allocation of additional 1% of groundwater availability in the protection zone and the conservation zone, and 2% in the existing zone. However, that conditional additional availability is conditioned upon applications demonstrating 125% mitigation. That is, that there will be a return of water through various conservation and other matters. And there's been some significant discussion about the ability to whether it makes sense to advance that capability and what level of confidence you could have that the mitigation programs, the conservation programs, would achieve the desired objective. If you look through the table, I think the implications, I've managed to misplace mine, I'm sorry, of where we have negative net water availability is very apparent. And again, we confront what I think is a relatively frequent issue in this plan and in many plans where you wish you'd started 15 years ago. And how do you balance the competing issues? And this is one that we have posited. We feel it merits serious consideration as to whether some preloading makes sense in order to promote progress. What we really want to do, because of all those red numbers, is improve the existing condition, not leave it as it is. But I think that's there's the map that shows the, and I couldn't possibly tell you what those colors mean in either the printed or the projected version, with or without glasses. I'm sorry.
Dan will take us through the colors. Please, Dan. He's got better eyes or glasses.
Basically, the blue shades are positives and all of the other shades are negatives. The darkest blue is from 100,000 to
Out damn spot.
Our chairman is debugging the system. The darkest blue is basically 100,000 to approximately 400,000 gallons per day of surplus. The medium blue is 50,000 to 100,000. And the lightest blue
you need a
is,
picture of this.
Is essentially
Councilman
zero,
fixes man.
Zero to 50,000. The lightest orange is negative
on the other
up
side.
To about 10,000. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's a, up to about 100,000 gallon per day negative. The darker orange
he's searching for water.
Is
come to the wrong place.
Searching for available water.
Yeah, I think we actually have
an animal
the dark red is basically a negative 1 to 7 million gallons per day negative, which is very significant. One thing I will note is that as an advisor to the Water Supply Advisory Council, I've seen preliminary information that DEP provided to the council, or showed to the council, on their analysis using their statewide thresholds, which are less stringent than ours. And the areas that we're seeing in red, by and large, are also red on their maps. They are not only beyond our thresholds, they're beyond the state's thresholds. So we do have some areas where, frankly, it's been known for a couple of decades that we have stressed groundwater supplies.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on that issue, the 1 to 7 million gallons a day deficit, and we're going to allow additional uses?
I'll pull up the map then.
Even at 125% mitigation, we're not going to make a dent in those deficits. And it just boggles my mind that we are actually going along with the policy that allows additional uses, additional water withdrawals in those areas.
I would state just the council will have to make a decision in terms of policy, but there are actually two policies that are important. One is that through conformance process, municipalities are going to be dealing with water management plans. And those water management plans are aimed at eliminating deficits. So the 125% isn't actually relevant to that process. Water management plans are aimed at eliminating deficits. The other issue, the 125% mitigation, is for the more minor water uses or the local, site-specific water uses that are proposed. And so they can be incorporated into what the municipality does with regard to water management plans, or, frankly, in a municipality that is not in conformance, does not go through the conformance process, that could apply wherever the council has some sort of review authority. So there are two different policies. It's important to keep both in mind, I would suggest, as to whether the council wants to go with those two policies. That's a different issue.
I would just like to point out that I really feel we should be prudent, and I would just like to say for one more time, we should wait until we see the results of those efforts before we start allowing further uses in deficit areas. I just think we're being irresponsible. And if we believe so greatly in the 125% mitigation effects, and if we believe so greatly in the water management plans, let's do them. Let's start moving upwards and see these deficits being reduced before we allow additional uses in those areas.
How would we do it? How would we do the 125% mitigation without allowing it?
Take it back. Water management plans. Let's begin the water management plans in those areas. And we have other aspects of other programs that we've put in place here, such as requiring that towns work to get grants in order to figure out how to better manage and conserve water resources in order to reduce demand. And we have those as other portions of other programs that we put in place here. Let's start seeing those programs work before we start allowing uses that are going to make that even worse.
Mr. Jim, I'd just like to comment that as I look at that map, those areas, including almost all of Precipity, are in a deficit, and they're all in the planning area. So we're going to, we can't just arbitrarily tell them you can't do anything anymore. And you know, what the municipalities have been doing is adhering to the DEP policies, which, if they're taking water out of the ground, says how much they can take out of the ground. And if you look at it, towns still have some capacity according to what they're allocated from the DEP. So maybe the DEP's allocation numbers have got to be tuned a little or whatever, but I'm not sure that that's something that we can address, unless when a town's going into conformance, we can caution them, let them know that they have this situation. But, you know, many of these towns, such as my own, are all built out, and it built out according to what the DEP said that we could do. And everybody thought that we were being responsible. Now we see a new piece of data that says, well, maybe the DEP restrictions were not strict enough. So the bottom line is, I'm not sure that we can do anything about some of those areas, except by, you know, working with them when we go to conformance.
I could see the potential for an interagency battle between the Highlands Council and the DEP, and applicants and so on, and municipalities. It could be get very messy.
Mr. Chairman,
I
think a good number in one of the documents in the program, it talks about, and it says very clearly that out of the 183 HUCs in the region, 110 are in deficit. And I think that that statistic is really the one that ought to be brought before. If that doesn't make you sit up and take notice, you know, I don't know what we're doing. But you know, the old adage of when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging, really applies to this. And I think Tracy's point is we should be enacting policies that do no further harm and indeed do go forward and try to restore this. Whether or not, you know, the past actions that got us here were in compliance with the law or not, clearly where those policies took us was problematic. And, you know, we're about going forward and what we're going to do both to restore the water resources but also make sure that there's no more harm done to it. And I think that's an argument or an idea that needs to really resonate throughout this and how we finalize this policy discussion.
I think that's the goal of this policy, but I think what you're both saying is you don't believe it will happen, that the conditions for additional development there will not in fact make the
John, I can't hear you.
Will not in fact make the water deficit situation better for Compton.
Well, we're having a policy debate about allowing further water to be taken out of watersheds that are in deficit, premised on the idea that there will be some mitigation or restoration. But we haven't seen, you know, the feedback yet from the staff that shows that that's indeed a viable alternative. So I think, you know, part of the message here is do no more harm until we really map out a way of going back and restoring some of the past damage that's clearly reflected in these numbers.
Let me ask Eileen, are we going to know any more about that before November 19th? Is there any, in terms of the effectiveness of those conditions of this part of the policy?
In terms of the water conservation and recharge enhancements, I've been doing a fair amount of research and I've been gathering information from a number of cases both in New Jersey and outside. So I'm going to be continuing that. I'm in conversation with DEP in terms of information that they've been compiling. So that material is coming together as fast as I can do so while doing all of the other writing we've been doing. But it's coming along. One of the interesting pieces of information that we did pull together, and just this is a little factoid to think about, you take an acre of roof in the Highlands, and we have a lot of roofs that are an acre or better, and you take that groundwater that stormwater that currently goes off to a stream through a normal stormwater system, and instead you recharge that, even including the evaporative losses, that's about 1 million gallons a year that would be recharged from 1 acre. So it gives you a sense of the possibilities in that side of things. Now, obviously, there are costs involved in this, but there are costs involved in everything. But it's just one piece of information that we've been pulling together and examples of where that's been done.
Well, something I've mentioned before going back to my town, since, you know, we went through an elaborate process to tie into the Jersey City Reservoir, the Bruton Reservoir. And as part of that, we had to come up with mitigation plans, which we had already pretty much done. And it had to do with conserving water. So just stopping sprinkling in the summer took us from, sometimes we would consume 12 million gallons a day, takes it back down to about 8. I mean, there's a huge amount of water to be saved just by putting in conservation measures.
Well, let me just say, I mean, I know there's not a lot of time between here now and November 19th, but the more information you could give us that would help us evaluate these concerns and whether we want to stay with this policy or change it would be
Mr. Great. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd just like to make sure that you all consider in your discussions, without intending in any way to try to direct you, that in the planning areas, if the municipalities choose not to conform, it's my understanding that the standard that will be applied for the threshold of removal is considerably greater than what this proposes. And I think that's an important consideration, that we have the ability, if the municipalities would create a program in which there is conformance, to apply what I understand to be a considerably lower threshold for potable water use than would otherwise be applied.
I mean, on that point, conformance is one implementation measure, and clearly the major one, but we have other authorities, if not only, it's sort of the power of persuasion, the DEP, to adjust their allocation program in the face of the science that's been updated for the first time in how many years. So we're not without other courses of action. I agree with you that clearly a lot of it rests on conformance, but it goes back to the same point that, you know, there are hard decisions facing this region that are a consequence of neglect for decades in terms of land use and natural resource protection. And are we going to simply walk away because we think that no one's going to want to make and face up to those hard decisions?
One thing, just as a point of information, just to help the council, we do have at this point a contract with the town of Clinton to do our first pilot water management plan. So, among other things, we're looking to see how they figure out how to address the water deficit that has been identified in their area. And that should be done within, certainly before plan adoption. That plan should be available to us as an example.
Mr. Chairman, on some of these, we have voted on various policies as we've gone along. And I think we held off voting on this one until we saw some of this data about the mitigation. And is that right? We didn't
right.
vote on this, right?
Right.
Okay. Because, right. I mean, I think at this point, we all thought collectively, let's look at some of that data before we actually take a vote on this, so council members would be better informed. Because, I mean, otherwise I would introduce right now to, you know, change the wording in this paragraph of this policy. But I will hold off. I do believe in infiltration and recharge. It's not that. I'm saying I think do no harm is a good way to put it. We should not allow any further uses until those programs have worked and they're already bringing us up out of the deficits before we allow further use in those deficit watersheds.
Can I ask how long that's going to take to determine whether the programs will work or not once they're implemented?
Most of the programs that I've seen as examples around the country have been multi-year programs. By their nature, you're either talking about infrastructure construction, or you're talking about doing the same thing in a lot of places. There are very few sort of mega big fixes where you just do one thing and the problem's solved. For instance, the one that I was looking at just today, New York City, they replaced water-wasting toilets with water-efficient toilets. And that sounds easy, but it was 1.3 million toilets. That takes time.
That was one Trump building, right?
All right, so this is the second issue that we're going to
The last paragraph in page 2, and excuse me if this is something you covered when I was absent in the previous meeting, agricultural net water availability is shown in the final three columns. As stated previously, it is only available for agricultural uses in a conservation zone sub-watershed. So what does that mean, then, for agricultural uses in a protection zone?
Oh, okay. Let me clarify. In the conservation zone, that 10% is only available for agriculture.
Okay.
In the other two zones, the agricultural uses really would be part of the total water use threshold for the zone. So the 5% in the protection zone, the 20% in the existing community zone, agriculture will be part of that. Within the conservation zone, it has a set-aside allocation. Or I shouldn't call that allocation because that's the DEP wording. This is set-aside amount of water, the 10%, that is only for the use of agriculture. And so the idea is that potable uses would not be able to infringe upon that.
So this needs different wording.
Yes.
But you're saying that in a protection zone, other uses could infringe on agricultural?
No, I'm saying that in the protection zone, all of the uses are lumped together, and they're compared to the 5% threshold.
What's the value of separating it, then?
The value of separating it for the conservation zone is that the Act very specifically spoke to the importance of protecting the agricultural landscape, and the conservation zone was very deliberately designed to include the vast majority of the agricultural landscape in the Highlands.
My concern would just be that we don't, that we not in some way cause a situation that water isn't available for agricultural users in the protection zone.
Can I just clarify that what we did, if it's different here from 2006, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, is to actually allow that extra use for agriculture in the conservation zone. What you had previously didn't allow for extra added protection, let's say, for the agricultural uses in that zone. What we've done is given more to ag in this iteration of this next generation of the plan.
But it's
to protect agriculture.
So you're suggesting then that you're putting a reserve in place so that if a farmer who doesn't currently have an agricultural water diversion chooses to seek one, there's a reserve in place so that approval can be granted by DEP. But we don't intend to infringe upon existing water diversions that are in place, regardless of where they are.
That's correct. That's my understanding, Dan.
If there is no deficit in the sub watershed, then you are where you are. If there's a deficit in the watershed, then the question is what mechanisms can be used to improve the situation and to get rid of the deficit. And those could look to both cost sharing with regard to agriculture to improve irrigation practices. It could be an emphasis on the non-agricultural side to make those kinds of changes. But in most cases, it's something where money has to be put on the plate to make things happen.
And that'd be for new diversions?
If it's in a deficit situation, we're looking to make the subwatershed no longer have a deficit. So that obviously, that has to focus on existing diversions. But then the question is the mechanism. And since the mechanism for agriculture would have to be cost share because of the nature of the regulatory system, that would be the mechanism for doing it.
So Farmer Brown has an existing diversion. They're in a protection zone. It's a HUP 14 with a deficit. 7 years has gone by. It's time to renew the diversion to DEP. They seek to renew at the same level, which is a number based upon acreage and crops and water usage per crop per acre. Is that going to trigger then some sort of review then at that point? Is that what you're suggesting? That you're going to say, well, your water diversion is a maximum that's 500,000 gallons a day. We've got a deficit situation. We want to see how we can reduce that potential usage?
This is getting very detailed for a discussion we haven't had with DEP yet. I think the better way for me to answer it is through the water management plan. The question would be, how can we bring that sub-watershed back into a non-deficit situation? And if agriculture can be a contributor to that, then what would be the mechanism to make it worthwhile to the farmer to do so? I can't speak to DEP's regulatory practices.
Well, what I'm trying to understand is how it's going to intersect and what authority the Highlands has over that process, or the Highlands Act, the council has over that process versus the DEP. Do we have any direct jurisdiction over the water diversions?
Yes, the Highlands Act does have a provision that specifically says, and Tim was alluding to this before, is that putting conformance aside, state agencies have an obligation, irrespective of conformance, in their regulatory programs to examine the implications of the Highlands Regional Master Plan. So there is a specific provision that does say that DEP's water allocation permitting process must look to the Regional Master Plan as they issue water allocation permits. So there is a process, but what Dan's alluding to is the specifics of how DEP would administer that as relation to the master plan requires additional discussion with the department.
And another complication is SADC and Department of Ag, because there's guarantees and the deed restrictions in preserved farmland that the only person that can restrict water use is the governor. You know, one of the benefits of being in farmland preservation is that no one can touch your water use unless it's deemed such a critical emergency that it needs to be restricted, and only the governor can do that.
This would require, to get right down to it, the Act does have this conformance or this
consistency
language, but it's also subject to the constraints of DEP's regulatory authorities. The Water Supply Management Act very clearly says that the department shall not take away an existing use where the people are actually using it without going through certain steps, and those are the steps that you're living. So it's one thing to take away a future allocation that has not been used and has no potential to be used. It's another thing to take away the water that somebody's using right now. Very different legal processes.
Thank you.
The last map I put up on the screen was the net water availability by HUC 14 with the conditional availability shown. That's that 1% and 2%. So that you have the discussion. That's just the map. The next matter before you is we're moving into programs now, and Dan did allude to this. This is the Highlands Restoration Water Deficits Program. The Highlands Council will continually update and verify the data utilized in its capacity assessments. Through the plan conformance process with municipalities and counties, the Council will obtain local scale information about water use and water supply from local governments and utilities. I'm sorry, I can see some of you are looking for this program.
Let's go to the chat.
Everybody has that program in front of them. We're trying to keep capacity issues together, which is why we put it in this order in the PowerPoint. So the first point really goes to updating and verifying the data utilized in our capacity assessments. That would be done continually. Where water deficits within a subwatershed are identified and validated, affected stakeholders will develop a strategic approach to addressing these shortages. All of these strategies must be detailed and implemented as appropriate and feasible through a water management plan. And that's what Dan had referred to. We wanted to go further and do this. You do this at the municipal level, consider it at a county level, and consider the development of HUC 14 water management strategies. And we would be expecting to coordinate with New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection on their water allocation program. This program is to attempt to get a handle on these deficits and to turn them around, basically. So that's the short version of that program. Mr. Schreier, you're now in command.
Motion to adjourn. Any comments on just
heard? I'll second it.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to say, as we get to all of these deficits, and if we looked across the state, we would probably see deficits in many, many places. And maybe once we get our plan adopted and all, we should really start to work on conservation plans that we should try to get the state to adopt across the board.
And Mimi, it's our what the council staff wants to do is the council decides to release this plan, we would immediately start working on these programs, fleshing them out, fleshing out the technical guidelines, all of those kind of documents. We do have standards in many of these programs. Others we want to work on, and as you see, as we, when we get to stream restoration, we obviously want to use what's already available statewide and nationwide and work with our consultants on that as well.
I think if Chairman Weingart were here, he would agree with that.
Wonderful. Well, I move Mr. Schreiber before he sits. Okay. The next program for you is termed redevelopment. This goes to your to smart growth elements and the redevelopment opportunities that exist within the region. The region master plan strives to accommodate regional growth and development needs primarily through the reuse and redevelopment of previously developed areas. The program helps interested parties, municipalities, counties, states, and federal agencies understand where redevelopment opportunities are targeted by the regional master plan. Now, we had spoken to you before about bringing to you a tool to assist in analysing where redevelopment potential exists. And I want to be very clear that, you know, we are delivering that tool, but that tool is a tool that's based on MOD4 data. What we consider it the tools we use during the conformance process as a starting point for municipalities. So using this tool, we've already done an analysis that gets to a starting point with municipalities of where they should first look for those redevelopment opportunities. And then we've analyzed developed areas and characterized them by their potential for enhanced growth opportunities. That is the tools which I speak. And what I want to do is show you some slides of how the tool works. I've got two slides here. In this figure, again using MOD4 data, we show a commercial corridor intersection, and the enhanced growth tool identifies these particular parcels, it is at a block and lot level, as economically underutilized, and that would be the MOD4 data where you look at the value of the land versus the value of the improvements. And if you can see that, if you look around the area, that it's underutilized in this particular block and lot, or these block and lots. It shows that these are potentially economically underutilized, and therefore there's a potential to redevelop in these areas. This is a transportation-rich area, and there's opportunities that exist for retrofitting the area by condensing the existing parking and infilling with additional development. Again, looking at this slide, you see a lot of impervious cover parking areas. And if it were to be, if there was an opportunity for the town to consider structured parking, you get at facilitating your parking and at the same time having the opportunity to do retail, office space, and even consider residential. So again, it's very rough, and the enhanced growth potential scores to the side. We did give you more information on these. This is how we would score the areas in terms of how much opportunity we see, how many indicators are present in these particular areas.
Higher number is greater development potential.
Potential. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, how does a municipality, and having been there and tried to do these things, okay, how do we go out and get, you need a developer to come in and join with you. Who's going to pay to do this? And yes, that isn't always easy to do. And so what can we do to try to promote this or put out, you know, some type of carrots to get them?
I think the first step is what we're attempting to do here, which is show where there's a possibility of opportunities. I think then we have to consider, I mean, we consider TDR in these cases as well. So there are many opportunities for discussion, but the first thing is to show the communities where the potential exists and start that conversation. I'm not saying it's an easy one, meaning
you know, most municipalities know this already, probably. They really do.
They do, but it's our job, again, we have a mandate under the Act to find these areas where the potential exists and to look for the potential for possible receiving areas into the future.
What we want to do is find a way to help them do it. An easy thing to do.
One thing that I would note, in looking at the slide, is a really good example. I'm willing to bet that site, from a zoning perspective, is fully developed. yet underutilized. And so one of the questions that comes up is, does the zoning actually constrain the ability to do this more intense mixed-use development? And in many cases it does. I'm familiar personally with an example in Arlington County, Virginia, where they had an area that was economically underutilized. They rezoned based on a transit stop, and all of a sudden you had massive redevelopment that was linked to the metro stop. So these kinds of things you have to think about, because I'm willing to bet that that's fully developed from a zoning perspective.
We did that, though. We implemented zoning that would accommodate, you know, much more smart growth and stuff like that.
But I think in cases like this, Eileen has said already at this meeting, we're not going to be requiring growth. So it's going to have to be that if there's a town or towns that would like to move ahead and have more growth in a way that's conforms with the plan, we work with them and identify whatever tools we could identify together to make that work.
See, what Amy's saying is she was a mayor of a town that was obviously very proactive in trying to seek out developers. And she mentions the TDR program, and somehow we're going to have to set the hook. Because not only are we going to be asking developers to come in, bring their pocketbooks with them, the cost of structured parking versus surface parking is approximately 5 times the cost. There's that there. And now we're also going to be asking them to pay for the HDCs. We're going to be asking them to also do upgrades to what other services are in town. And we're really going to have to get creative and aggressive. Not to mention if we go back and we look at what the watershed's doing, I mean, the capacities we're already doing with the water. That's all in that argument. So.
And I did want to point by, I reversed and go back to the previous slide as well to show you that there were a couple of other ideas we had. One was to really take a page out of the book from the Office of Smart Growth that has the BRIT team, the Brownfields Redevelopment Interagency Team, and the suggestion on staff was that we would seek to streamline redevelopment process by establishing a Highlands Interagency Team. And that BRIT team has proved to be very successful on many projects, because what they do is they bring together the different state agencies, Department of Environmental Protection, Department of Transportation, and then others as relevant, transit, maybe ag in
economic
certain cases.
Development.
They sit, yes, EDA, commerce, they sit together in one room and advise an applicant, that kind of interagency team. They tell them what the permitting process is, you know, what they're up against in that way, what the grant potential is. Who's out there that can assist them. So development of that interagency team is one idea we thought. I mean, we're trying to put together sort of a toolbox of ideas. The other was, we do have the money for grants, and we can give communities grants that would assist them in working to see, to have these kind of projects and to see what they want their communities to be and to have that opportunity for revitalization. It has worked in other areas across the state. And so we're trying to, again, not always try to recreate something new, but to look at where there has been success and offer those opportunities. The second slide with the enhanced growth potential, the redevelopment potential tool, this figure shows several commercial parcels bordering a residential neighborhood. Again, this tool identifies these parcels as economically underutilized and located within a transportation-rich urban enterprise zone. Again, sometimes it's the zoning which restricts a certain type of development that maybe would end up in the highest and best use of these areas. And so the tool, as I said, is just a place to start. It's something we committed to develop for you. It gets to block and lot level information across the whole region, and at least will assist municipalities in the beginnings of a conversation.
Before you move off the redevelopment of the package here and program, I'm going to pick on one of my favorite nits, which is on page 3 in the preservation area redevelopment, Grayfield redevelopment. now that you have an English major on the staff, perhaps that could be proofread throughout the.
Mr. Schreier, I will confess that I did do some research on that, and I think it's going to prove a difficult argument, because the use of the spelling, my research showed it's spelled both ways in many different areas, but the use of the color was to try to capture the fact that impervious cover already exists, and those are gray areas just as the brown fields and your green fields. And so I did see that, that you are supported in some cases in the spelling as AY and in others an EY. And so I don't quite know. I think the council may have to tell us which way they want to spell it.
I'll tell you the answer here, that the EY fans are wrong.
then I think that if then we would spell it AY.
We're in a gray
if we,
area here.
Right? The perk of being a member of the council, we each get to choose how to spell one word.
I can even roll up my sleeves if you want.
But in the attempt always to be diligent and to pay attention to when Mr. Schreier leads us, I will also tell you that in terms of research following what he's asked us to do in looking up karst, it's a Slovenian region known as KRAS, where they first did the study of the carbonate areas. The German term for that, the German name for the karst region of Slovenia is karst. So we are trying to keep up with you, Mr. Schreier, but on grey I found myself, I think we need the council to tell us which way you want us to spell it, and we will follow.
That leads us right to discussing karst.
The karst program is, and these next programs are, they're not departures from anything or requiring a policy decisions. In fact, what they are the programs that are based on the policy decisions you've already discussed under goals, policies, and objectives. The carbonate rock or karst topography program is, again, it's to deal with how we will deal with the issue, having mapped the region as we committed to doing so. The Highlands Council will identify the critical requirements for development ordinances. Highlands Council will develop a technical guidance manual for use by municipalities that have lands that are within or drain to the carbonate rock area. And working with municipalities during site plan and subdivision approval process will establish and maintain an inventory of karst features that are found in the Highlands region. The next program is on the restoration of streams and riparian areas. Again, the Highlands Council will develop technical guidance for use by municipalities for the restoration of impaired streams. We've begun the research to look for guidance that already exists, because we will borrow from that and use in our own guidance. And existing guidance manuals are the stream restoration design developed by the Natural Resources Conservation Service, stream corridor restoration developed by the Federal Interagency Stream Corridor Restoration Working Group. Those are two examples that we will use in our work. Further, the Highlands Council will develop or adapt technical guidance for use by municipalities for the restoration of impaired riparian areas. Stream corridor restoration, again, that the program that was developed by the Federal Interagency Stream Corridor Restoration Workshop would be used as one example for that. The program for historic resource protection. This program is designed to identify where historic, archaeological, and cultural resources exist within the region, and to provide guidance and support to local government entities in managing and protecting those resources. In this program, municipalities will be encouraged to establish a historic preservation commission, adopt ordinances, zoning rules, development regulations, and programs that protect these resources and address their potential reuse and rehabilitation. Adopt guidelines and/or regulations where appropriate to address the issue of teardowns. And the Highlands Council will develop a historic preservation manual to provide guidance, technical assistance, and potential funding information. And as we did with the streams and riparian areas, we're already looking to where those kind of programs exist to borrow from those and utilize them in the formation of our own programs and technical guidance.
A question that relates to your last sentence. The state has manuals for historic preservation. There wouldn't seem to me to be any resources particularly unique to the Highlands that I don't know why we need to have a manual separate from what the state has.
And that may indeed be the case. We want staff to research those and look into it and perhaps just use those particular manuals.
Well, if that's the case, maybe we should say we may develop a manual.
May develop.
Because there may be some conflict. Well, we have goals and objectives and storage projects, but in general.
It might be, but this is a goal, the guidance, I guess, but this is telling what assistance is available.
actually, the element is historic, archaeological, and cultural elements, and there may be, while historic has been used as a headline here, there may be some additional materials that aren't available currently at the state level that relate to this particular region that would be included.
I have a question on that. When would that be available? During conformance? I mean, is this, where's the timeline on this?
What we intended to do was as soon as the council has released the next generation, we start moving into doing that work, to getting the technical guidance documents together, because we would have that as an appendix to the regional master plan.
But that, so you're saying that manual would be available by the time we adopted the plan? Or?
I'm saying we start the work on having them.
So something like this language is what would probably be in the adopted plan, just like correct. The adopted plan would say this is an agenda item of the council to develop.
Yes. That's why I said earlier, some of the programs already have the standards in them, and we'll be refining those as we get to data of considered release. Some of them we'll be continuing to work on.
Okay. I mean, can I ask you a question about going forward once the plan has been adopted and all? We have a lot of additional work to do. Are we going to set up a priority schedule for which things the council feels are most important, like conservation measures?
Actually, staff are having a meeting this Monday to start that work, to start putting forth a priority schedule for these, because and then we will be recommending that to you and sharing that with you.
Start
so we've already started it.
So we can be commenting.
Yeah, and also because we want to have a program for our own work, because we're at a certain point now with this next generation draft. Oh, we have. It's a question really of prioritization, never of finding anything to do. The day isn't long enough.
Mr. Chairman, on the program description part of this, is why is it that we are only requiring the conformance element to minimize? It says municipal county government shall, as a requirement of conformance, impose a development review condition that all development proposals that may affect historic, archaeological, or cultural resources shall demonstrate how such impacts will be minimized. Why is this standard not avoided where possible, or something stronger than minimized?
Right, sir. I mean, if you want us to refine the language, and I'll make sure that council advises, Tom advises us, well, that we have
what
the...
What was the thinking behind
it?
Well, I may have asked Tom a question differently, which is, does the Act, I mean, historic cultural resources, our obligation to protect them, is it on par with our obligation for natural resources? And if it is, then why isn't this stronger?
The protection of historic is in both goals for preservation area and the planning area.
Right. Okay. So this does not seem to rise to the level then of what the statute directs us to do as far as those resources are concerned.
It could be a matter of just inference. When we think of minimized, one of the things you first do is you avoid impacts if possible. And that's part of minimization, but we can spell it out if that would be preferable.
I would think, unless anyone disagrees, I think that would be a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll have the language changed on that. Yes. Strengthened.
One problem that you have is what is historic and what is significant.
Gotcha.
And you're going to find that lots of public endeavors, when you're going through development, require an archaeological survey to be done and a determination be made.
Right.
And then some determination is made as to the value of what's found. Now, if it's a basement of a building, is it historical or not? That's part of the issue that you wind up wrestling around every time you deal with one of these. So you have to be pretty definitive. And maybe preservation is moving a graveyard, for example, as opposed to keeping it in sight. So there are lots of, I mean, it's a lot more complex than this could hope to express.
Right.
And really the devil's in the details.
But this one, I suspect, is simple compared to the final one on the list, which is huge resource.
I'm not going there.
Well, I was just mentioning with Jack, you should somewhere in here mention that we should encourage, you know, the counties to provide grant money. Morris County now uses some of their open space money to fund historic preservation, and it's been being used very wisely, I think.
The only caveat is that the application has to be made. money is there, but the application for its use or its granting has to be made.
Turned me down. It
could be made by a nonprofit. It could be made by a municipality. It could be made by any number of entities. Mm-hmm. And there's significant money there. We took, this was my creation, by the way. We took a 5% allocation from the Preservation Trust Fund, which had originally been designed to cover soft costs in the beginning of this program in 1993, and found that we have been generating so much money that the 5% was underutilized, to use a familiar term. And so we had more money in that 5% than we needed, and I recommended that we create a historic preservation program. This was 4 years ago. And we went back to the voters with an additional referendum for subsequent use. The voters approved it overwhelmingly. That money has been well since. You need to make an application.
So we should say that municipalities throughout the seven Highland counties should all apply to Morris County for.
You're all welcome to do that.
You can all come to Bergen County to ask
them. Well, I think there is a sentence in here. I mean, you know, it does say municipalities are encouraged to use a range of methods to identify.
Maybe
one other historic comment. It's one thing to identify. The other thing is to preserve and maintain, and that's infinitely more expensive and difficult than it is to identify for
this. Well, that's where the Historic Preservation Trust Fund portion comes in.
All right, I don't think anyone's suggesting any changes in this program as it's drafted, pointing out some of the complications, so let's move on to the final one on that.
I'll take this one, but I do want to make an observation. We continue, as we have all through this, to continue to work, and there will be, I believe, some additional articulation of both the prior historic archaeological and cultural programs and the scenic resources, which we're continuing to work on. As we speak, Lane and I spent a significant portion of today working on these two elements. The Scenic Resource Program establishes a procedure for first identifying the regionally significant scenic resources within the region, and then to identify methods to preserve those resources when they've been identified. There has been a baseline inventory that's been identified. I think it's 131. That have been identified as candidates. There'll be a process that's will be established for a nomination of additional ones, and then criteria that will be used to determine which one of them are significant. And then through a variety of programs, including the local government conformance process, there will be programs to protect both specific vistas and specific kinds of vistas. For example, there are locations that have scenic character within the region that are unique and important. There are also lakes have a certain set of scenic attributes that need to be respected, and there'll be program elements under each of those. It will be a combination of municipal conformance, identification, nomination, cooperation, collaboration, and ultimately, this is one that I think will, however, be largely implemented through the municipal conformance process. That you can't buy a vista very easily, unfortunately. Though the Blue Ridge Parkway did a wonderful job of doing that many years ago, but I think that may have been our last chance for something like that. And this one, as I said, is something that Lane and I are continuing to try to put more flesh on the bones of where it goes, but ultimately, I think this has the essence of what the plan can really do. It does interrelate, though, to the Lake Management District components are very important with the vistas around that, and the ridge line protection ordinance, the steep slope regulations will go to helping to preserve some of the scenic character of those special vistas in the region.
Let me ask Tim's question, maybe Tom, about what the Act says about scenic resources.
I'll have to double check on that. I know it's true for historic, but I know scenic's address, I just can't remember exactly the scope of it.
That's
okay.
I have a question.
Oh, there's another component I meant that we're also the public the view from the public realm along the roads is an important part of the character of the region, and so we are addressing, Lane and I spent some considerable time talking about that as a really a set of guidelines for how you treat your public roads. It's simply a matter of forethought in most cases.
Question. In identifying these 131 potential sites, we must have established some baseline criteria. Who did that, and have we seen it?
We have the procedure.
It was essentially already preserved state lands and the additional public lands.
I know we discussed it at the Natural Resources.
We did, and we also put procedures. I think we've got the, we're taking public comment on those. They were put on the website, and we have received public comment. In fact, Helen Heinrich sent me public comments, and I've responded to her and made sure that they're maintained in the file on comments received on the procedures. She also commented on the program.
So what would you anticipate on the status of those 119 sites being in the November 19th in the draft plan?
Baseline will remain, by that time we'll have more meat on the procedures for the nomination process.
So there may be additions to it eventually.
But in order to have a nomination process, don't we first have to approve what the criteria is to be valid as a scenic site?
Yes.
And that's the purpose of the procedures.
The procedures that are on the line
are out for public comment. So the expectation is that at some point the council will, in fact, approve those procedures.
They were before the Natural Resources Committee. The Natural Resources Committee
put
them out for public comment.
In
the middle of pumpkin season. But we only put them out for public comment, Kurt, so you will see them again at that committee with the comments received before they go to the council.
Could we be refreshed on that? Can we see what they are?
Absolutely. We'll refresh you.
I'm certainly willing to take a look at it now, but anyone else wants to
do it?
We'll
know there's seconds too. Are they 131 in the technical report? I think the 131 are in the technical reports that were originally distributed in conjunction with the 2006 plan.
That's at the bottom of the very sick pile.
We'll gladly provide an update.
My reason, Mr. Chairman, for commenting is just that I continually fear that this is such a subjective component of the act that you can be nominated into oblivion. Somebody might like the old shed that you had every intention of knocking down and replacing, and all of a sudden some person from Hudson County happened to drive by and enjoy the vista of your old shed because it had some nice wood on it, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation where you're hindered from showing with your own property what you want to do with your own property. And that's why I think it's important to really consider what the criteria are and what it says.
One item we skipped on the agenda was 9A, which was the comment period on the regional master plan. I'm not going to cut off discussion on the substance of it, but I just wanted to get that, which was we've been sort of vaguely talking about a 30-day comment period in the last council meeting. Jack suggested a 60-day comment period, and I sent an email to all of you saying I thought that made sense, and I just wanted to make sure everyone was comfortable with that. What that would mean would be if we do, in fact, put out a revised draft or adopt voted support of a revised draft plan on November 19th, we have a comment period that would run through something like January 25th or somewhere around that. We have a public hearing during that period, and we would move accordingly in terms of reviewing public comments and making whatever revisions we might make before adopting the plan. Hope that everybody comfortable with that. Other comments on the presentation or the substance of this before we public comment is the next item on the agenda. So.
I just have one really minor thing about the stream restoration program. What my staff told me today, the DP is proposing in their wetlands rules that in stream bank restoration, if there are non-native plants that have been planted, that you can replant non-native plants. And I would hope that we would take steps to correct that and to restore native plants when restoration work is going on. So.
Yeah, and we've actually dealt with that in lake management areas, but your point is well taken.
Thank you.
I have a couple comments.
Yes, Debbie.
For public comment. You know, I've sat back and looked at the process we followed over the last couple of months and where we are, and a couple of issues have come to mind, and I'd like to lay them out for the council. I'm uncomfortable with certain parts of this process, and one of them is that we see factors removed from this map, factors added, and what apparently will be, I thought that a change in the land use capability map, which is the heart of the plan. I'd like to, and without really deliberation, oversight consent by the council, I think, you know, which is very different from how we proceeded with the first draft. I think the council should see a table showing clearly what factors have been removed, what factors have been added, and we should at least review that and make sure we're comfortable with that. Also, the implications of the change in those factors, and I've not been able to look at the map, so and I apologize for that. I haven't read anything or heard anything, though, that says I've missed what I'm looking for, which is, I think we need to see a table showing with the changes in acreages in these various zones. Maps each for each municipality, excuse me, a number of acres of protection zone for RSC1 versus RSC2. And this is something we should, again, look at and understand the implications of before we go forward. Also, it occurred to me that we had many discussions, public comments about how much growth can be accommodated as limited by capacity, water, and sewer in these purple zones. I haven't seen anything yet that would lead us to what we used to call various shades of purple. Have I missed something? Or did not visually see in the map today, or has that not been done yet?
I think you missed something. But I think that's pretty much what we've been seeing today and over the last several meetings.
But by capacity? Driven by capacity, not just environmental constraints.
Well, Eileen just handed out a table to members, which maybe she could describe.
The table shows the delta. Sorry, thank you, Tony. The table shows the delta between the November 2006 release, these zone map there at that time. Called the land use capability map, and the one that we were speaking to today and showing you the changes. There was an abstract sent to all members of the council, which is available to the public today, which details the development of the model. We did have the abstract available for the last model, and so I can send that out to anybody again who wants to compare those side by side, but the other one was publicly available. The chart now shows the changes, and in the protection zone, November 2006, there were 557,507 acres. In the map that was that we spoke to today, would be 469,530. 1,000 acres. The difference is a reduction in the protection zone of 87,000 acres, 87,977 acres. Percent change is a reduction of approximately 16%. The existing community zone has gone from 149,624 acres to 146,037 acres. The existing community constrained subzone shows 32,175 acres. The lake community subzone has 20,698 acres. The conservation zone has in 2006 had 152,227 acres. In this next generation map has 70,284, but the conservation constrained subzone has 120,000 acres, 634. If you look to see what the difference is in terms of constrained lands, the total constrained lands in November 2006 were 557,507 acres. They are now increased to 643,037 acres. That is from approximately 65% constrained lands in 2006 to 75% constrained lands in 2007.
And that's a table you just handed out today with that email, sir.
And that was just handed out just now.
We just completed this today, Debbie.
It seemed like your question was a setup.
And it looks like that was. Thank you, Eileen. My other comment was that, you know, we opened the comment period on this 10 months ago, and we really should have had some sort of summary document of an actionable nature by now that would have allowed us to review what the key comments were. And to review staff recommendations for what to address and not to address. We've had no role in that. I don't think that's appropriate. I mean, it's all I've heard. I appreciate all the work the staff did in compiling it and what we've been told many times. Our revision is responsive to it, but I see no evidence of that. And I'm uncomfortable with going forward with this plan without seeing that, and I think that's something that should be put together. When are we going to see a complete document if we're still on a track to vote to release this November 19th?
Why don't you take the second question first?
What we've been doing this time around is showing you the documents piece by piece. They will be the complete documents. So in other words, you saw the vision document. Then you saw goals, policies, and objectives. You're seeing the programs. You're seeing the maps. They are all part of what will be the complete document. I've also sent you to sort of keep you abreast of the changes. I sent you a two-sided goals, policies, and objectives to show you where we've been revising those since we gave you that document, consistent with the comments we've been receiving from you and the actions taken at these meetings. So you are in fact seeing parts of the final document.
If we look at the packet you sent us for the draft packet for November, for next week's meeting, including that, have we then seen a draft of every section of the proposed draft? Or there's some?
Yeah, except for the last chapter, which is implementation, which is just which will show which agencies are responsible for which actions. But other than that, yes, you'll have seen it all. Chapters 1 and 2. 2 will be updated with the data and analysis that has been shared with you with these maps. And chapter 3 is the vision statement, which has been shared with you. So, yes, apart from the fact that there will be some refinement of those documents pursuant to your comments and direction to us.
And in terms of Debbie's other question about the comments, response to comments?
We did share with...
Response to comments, excuse me, John.
Excuse me, what?
Actionability based on the comments that have been heard and compiled.
What we did was we gave all council members the different categories and the different comments in a summary version so that you could see what the comments are. Staff will prepare a comment response document, but what we were doing was responding to the comments and letting you know that as we've gone through this process at these last meetings. And then at the end of that, we will be able to write a response document because it has to say what changes we've made in the plan in response to those comments, so we need your action in order to complete that document. But we did share with you a summary to assist you. We have the full information available on the website. We shared that with you on the members only website and on the public website, but we've also shared with you a summary document to assist you.
And I'm not suggesting we haven't had access to the comments. The issue is that the staff has proceeded without any deliberation and consideration by the council, without any direction from us, whether to the importance or relative significance of these comments. And again, which is separate from a response document that you have after public hearings, I want to lay that out there, that is somewhat troubling and puts into question what we have done and not done, at least in my mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other members who share that feeling? Sorry. We're not adopting a rule, so we're not legally bound to have a comment response document. But we're doing it anyway. Okay. All right. Are there any other comments before we turn to public comments? Council comments before we turn? All right. Are there any members of the public who have not spoken to the council before? Members of the public who would like to speak? Ken?
I think I have spoken, and I'm sorry. I apologize. I just wanted to talk a little bit and take you back to the mapping and the policy 60.
Can you identify yourself, Ms. Burke?
Well, I'm Candy Ashton, and I serve on the Finance Commission for 28 years. I would just like to speak to you a little bit from that experience. I'm not talking on behalf of the commission, please.
Come on.
That was not a single
sure? Anyway, I just wanted to talk about, you know, you thought you were going to be out there planning and saving the world, and now you're talking about septic systems and water-conserving toilets. Just be ready, because that's going to go on for a very long time. I wanted to talk about that policy 6B3, which allows for changing in the what we would call a management area. This is, I think, using the word municipal flexibility in regard to this is wrong. That isn't what's happening here. What's happening here is that there's other data, fine down data that comes through from the municipal or county level, but usually the municipality. And what you want to be able to do is to adjust the map. We had had many of these, and they're usually minimal changes. They're changes where, for instance, in one town in the Pines, they grew gladioli, but the farm community didn't want that to be an ag area because that wasn't agriculture. Happened. Well, basically what happened was that the data was different, and so those changes were made. What we try to do is have them not only minimal, but also have them do all the things that are allowed in here as protecting the ecosystem equally. But basically, they usually end up being a no net change. In other words, you have an agricultural area, you have a development area, you have a forest area, and basically you just mismapped them so that in the end it comes out no net. There's no difference in the overall effect on the ecosystem. We paid dearly once for making a big change. The courts made us take it back. So I would just urge a couple of things. One is take the flexibility thought out of your head, that it's not flexibility, it's data, and how the data is reflected. And if they can prove that you've got the wrong approach, and they should be minimal, and they should result in probably net areas all being the same. Then I wanted to say a couple of words to you about septic systems. You'll come to hate them before you're through. Testing and monitoring septic systems is extremely difficult and not done very often. Massachusetts does a lot. Rhode Island's done a lot. And now the Pinelands has done a lot. And I would just want to tell you what we've been through. For instance, we thought everything would be solved by having composting toilets in the 70s, where everybody was deciding that was the answer to everything. Everybody took the compost out and put it on their flower garden, and no nitrates left the site, you know, theoretically. So, and then there's something called the RUC systems, pressure dosing systems. What we've really found out is that regular systems have the same result as pressure dosing. The fancier you get, the less improvement you get. So we're really back to two things. One is alternate systems, which are like package plants. And that's one way for us to take care of grandfathered small lots. But that's the only kind of place we have them used. and in the villages and so on, and regular systems, which require a 3.5-acre land piece of land in order for dilution to be the solution to pollution. So I think I just wanted to bring up those two things because this conversation will have to go on for a very long time, and there are some lessons to be learned, and there's a lot of research on what actually comes out of a septic system that you might want to refer to. It's not what comes out after it goes through sand rather than what you have up here. I mean what comes out of the bottom of the system. There's very little of that kind of research anywhere. So I just wanted to say those two things, but I really do want you to look back at this policy 6B3, which I understand you're going to be working on, because it is not a question of flexibility. There are things that have to be done to be flexible for the municipalities, but that isn't one of them, because that's a data issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other comments? Okay, where's my show?
Everybody's obviously exhausted. I just first of all wanted to thank the council for trying to address, this is Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I want to thank the council for introducing the environmentally constrained subzones. I need an opportunity to really think it through, but I really appreciate the fact that you're trying to respond to all the comments. On policy 6B3 for future land use, boy, are you ever opening a can of worms. This is just another place where you're going to have to be the leader when there are difficult decisions on challenging issues. There will be many chances for some give and take with municipalities during conformance, but I'm not sure that map adjustments and map flexibility is one of them. I think you are creating a nightmare for yourselves. Unless, as Candy suggested, you make sure that there is no net change as a result. If you insist that it must be a possibility, then the standards or criteria for permit or map adjustments must be very high and protective, and never lose sight of cumulative impacts on the resources that you are supposed to be protecting. This policy or this approach could turn into a death by a thousand cuts, which I would argue is one of the reasons for a passage of this act in the first place. On water supply, maybe this now is the opportunity for the council to request DEP to make sure their water supply master plan is consistent with the RMP, and you will anticipate all kinds of problems that won't happen. Now's the chance before it comes out. They're supposed to be consistent with everything else. It would be entirely appropriate for them to be consistent with the Water Supply Master Plan to be consistent with the RMP. Net water availability. I was very troubled by the discussion that I heard. We have really serious challenges and problems ahead of us with water availability, and agriculture has to be part of the solution. I recognize that the industry is probably more tied to water and water availability than most, but not all. Given the magnitude of the problem we are facing, agriculture, including existing diversions, has to be part of the solution. Worldwide, agriculture has become far more sophisticated, and many opportunities for improvement on what exists today are available to the industry. I really appeal to the farming community not to hold themselves above everyone else. We're all in this together, and I really hope that the council will make sure that everybody is part of the solution, because we've got a big problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Can you see a show of hands if everybody would like to comment, please? Okay. Great. Okay.
Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. I'll just make a few short comments about the topics that people have already spoken about. I hope that the maps that were up today will be available on the website, the water availability, the water deficit, and the septic maps, et cetera. I hope those will be up on the website for us, or accessible through the website to be downloaded.
All the documents that we put on the back table are on the website now.
But there are no colored maps there.
We can try to get those maps up as soon as we can.
All right. I would urge in the maps to keep the colors on the land use capability map were not comparable to the colors on the old map, and I would really urge that the green protection zone, brown conservation, and purple with some modifications for the constrained areas, but it's just really helpful to have the colors stay the same so you can kind of tell where the changes are. Anyway, that would be useful, I think. I thought I'd just make a brief comment about the Scenic Resource Protection Program and point out that the Highlands, the existing scenic resource inventory is right now, it only consists of federal open space and state parks, state open space, state parks, wildlife management areas, and county open space. I would urge the council to add things to this list. It does not even include the Highlands Trail. It does not include municipal open space that's already on the Green Acres Rossi list. It certainly should include that. In my opinion, it should also include preserved farmland, which has been preserved by people's taxes from all over the state, and the public has an investment in seeing that farmland, the scenic values are not impacted, and I think the farmland should be on that, the preserved farmland. And I would urge the council to take the initiative and put those things on its scenic resources inventory, as well as undertake processes to identify regional resources that cover more than one town, such as ridgelines, such as scenic roads, trails, streams, which are not necessarily appropriate to leave to municipal initiatives. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I just comment that not all Green Acres are really scenic vistas. I don't think that our roller hockey rinks, which are on our Rossi, would qualify as scenic vistas to most people. We like them.
Yeah. No, I agree. But there are certainly a great many, that are recreation areas that are scenic even. And
Marion Harris, Morris County Trust for Historic Preservation. I'd like to say one thing slightly off my usual subject and then put on my horse blinders again and talk about my usual subject. But this isn't totally off the subject. It's about riparian areas. Those are the places where you are more likely than anywhere else to have a reason for looking for archaeological sites. Even if nobody has found them so far, it's more than likely around here that on stream banks there will be something archaeological. And it would be nice if we could just have the word in there in the programs at the program level saying, be sure to do your archaeology before you go on and restore the bank because it might be there. I know that the other overlay programs would apply, but it might be nice just in that particular case to have that. Okay, now, let's talk about the historic resource stuff. I'm delighted to see from the language that everybody seems to be beyond the level of idiomatic discomfort, and you are talking now like preservationists. Maybe you've had a little help, but it sounds much more relaxed and natural. There are a couple of general things that I would like to say. One of them
is that it's not entirely clear whether you understand that there are two kinds of municipal historic preservation commissions in the state. I know that that's a very murky statute, and it's murky because it's written murkily, not because it's legalistic. A lot of people have confusion about that. But when you move on to talk about we're going to encourage municipalities to establish commissions that will provide advice, it's not entirely clear that you are not saying we will not encourage them to establish regulatory commissions, we will encourage them only to establish advisory commissions. And that's a very sad thing. In general, it's pretty sad to lean on municipalities and their preservation commissions anyway, because those of you who have worked with your local commissions and with those in other towns may or may not be aware that the trend these days with municipal preservation commissions is that they are beginning to curl up into very small balls and disappear. And even those that had some teeth originally are moving to dentures. So it is very sad, and I have spent the last week wondering how long I'm going to stay in this field, because there's not much to eat. But I think that you need to be aware that you are leaning on a three-legged stool which has lost a couple of its legs if you are trying to pass that job off to the municipalities. Even though they like to see that you are letting them play the game, that is not a very good way to protect historic resources these days. That's a sad thing to be saying, because it's coming too close to my heart. But in any case, there is this problem that we have enabling legislation in the state for historic preservation. And it says if you want to do design review in New Jersey, you have to do it by being a municipality and setting up a commission and doing it there. So where does the Highlands Council stand in this legal hierarchy of organizations that are allowed to do design review? Because the municipalities have the authority to do it on their level. The State Historic Preservation Office has the authority to do it under law, which is often federal law. But there is no place in between for any entity, government entity, to do design review. So you're going to have to change the world a little bit. Not that you're going to have to do that anyway, but that if you want to be the perpetrators of design review, which is what you're actually saying you're going to do here at some point, you're going to have to make a place for yourselves legally, and I'm not sure what that place is. So I'm not complaining about this. I'm just saying that it might be a good thing for you to do it, but get busy and do it if that's the way you want to do it. It is enormously rewarding to see you talking about guidelines for teardowns specifically. That's a very important issue in the field, and it's very, very useful to have you mention it. The other thing it's useful to have mentioned is the whole business about historic transportation infrastructure, which is so important in the Highlands and in all of New Jersey, and that deserves special protection. One other thing I would like to ask you about is of the matter of building up the inventory, because you seem to be talking in your programs about getting inventories that already exist. And of course you know that if you do that, you're going to have to struggle with lots of different sets of standards, because everybody who has a commission, every municipality that has a commission, is required to have a master plan that includes an inventory of some sort. And they're required to say what the standards were that they used to do that. But the standards can be, we liked it, that's why we put it on our inventory. Or they can be, we used the National Register standards. That's the other end of the requirement. Both of those are probably wrong for a municipality to use. And so they should be specific, and the more you see, the more you wonder what's in those surveys.
So, first of all, there is the inconsistency in local surveys. And second, I don't see, there's nothing to prevent it, but I don't see any anticipation that you will have your survey built up by the cases that come before you to decide. And that is, I don't know whether you saw that very detailed set of comments that I gave you about the 106 procedure, but that is a procedure that is used to implement, to augment the state's inventory of historic things. Anytime somebody is coming for a judgment, they have to say, are there any historic resources in the way? How good are they? What are they like? And they usually have to hire somebody to do that. So there's your chance of getting the work done for you by applicants and augmenting your inventory. So that would be a good thing to say. That, I think, is it, although probably when I get home, I'll think of some more. Okay. Thank you.
Rob, is there somebody else who wants to speak? Okay, Helen. We'll amend to speak at next week's meeting.
Hello, Helen Heinrich, representing New Jersey Farm Bureau. You can tell from Marion's very detailed set of advice that the subjects of historic preservation and scenic preservation are very complex and potentially contentious. One problem I see is that there's a lot of experience with historic preservation. There's a lot of incentives and benefits and grants and so forth for historic preservation, and it's got to be the same for scenic. It's got to be worked out that landowners and owners of property that is going to be protected for the public for those purposes gets also some kind of incentives or compensation or something for what they are offering to the public. And please, I sent very detailed comments on the scenic resources, and I understand Charlie's still working on it, so could Eileen, could you please give him my comments?
Because
I believe there's several very practical suggestions. Good. But I'm wondering, with the big stack of material, should we continue to try to get comments to you by early next week? It's beginning to look to me like we should wait until the whole plan comes out and give you comments. That things are pretty well set, the wording, given the consensus in this room. So what do you advise groups like us to do with our review of what we're getting each time here?
Well, I mean, when we consider the whole document, members of the council can bring up any changes they want to bring up. So to the extent you have comments where you think there are things we should change, you should let us know.
In advance of the 19th, I guess.
The way I anticipate the meeting on the 19th working is that we will discuss the document and consider amendments from council members, and then before having a vote on the document, have public comments.
But next week you won't be rediscussing anything that's come up until
Rediscussing the municipal conformance, the section that Candy wants us not to call flexibility.
What else will be on the agenda next week?
We'll have the agenda on the website. It may be there already, but
we'll have it up by tomorrow, the agenda. We'll get it up by tomorrow week for next Thursday's meeting.
Mr. Chairman, if you would like to make comments now, before the 19th, based on what you've heard because of your presence at these meetings, I mean, you've been a very attentive student here. There was no reason why you cannot submit comments now that could be considered.
All right.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, but I'm not sure I want to spend the weekend in order to get them in by Monday, you know.
Right.
But we certainly will do that and get them to you as soon as we can. And did I hear that there's an extension of the public comment period? I mean, that kind of snuck by from...
Well, we never had set a public comment
period. You never set a date, so now you've set a date of January 25th.
No, I threw out that date. We're talking about a public comment period of approximately 60 days. So if we do, in fact, approve this on November 19th, I said January 25th, right. It's a Friday somewhere around there.
Right. Okay, well, I just wanted to make sure that.
I assume that you, do you disagree with extending having a commentary of that length? Or?
No, indeed.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Anyone else wish to speak? Okay. I would say, I think Julia Summers was going to say that she has a car full of lawn signs for that. So.
Not quite here, yes. Oh. 24 of them, I would like these to have. I promised actually every single one that's left to Bill Carter.
Okay.
He doesn't need two anymore.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
My car is right outside.
very exciting. Now, what do you like? I'm working on it. I am.